WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our 30 Issues election series with Issue 24, Equal Pay for Equal Work, and maybe even comparable work. Let's listen to some history.
I'm pleased that we can meet together today as the Equal Pay Act of 1963 goes into effect all across this great land of ours.
President Lyndon Johnson signing a law that was a century in the making. A history article in Time magazine cites a letter to the editor of the New York Times in 1869, noting that the U.S. Treasury Department employed 500 women, but they only made $900 a year on average, half what men were making for the same jobs. Congress passed an equal pay bill for federal workers the next year, 1870, but it didn't cover state and local government employees or any of the private sector. In 1883, Western Union telegraph workers went on strike for equal pay in that corner of the private sector, but the strike failed to achieve its goals. It took until 1911 for New York City public school teachers to be granted equal pay, according to Time. And as late as the 1960s, newspapers had help wanted men and help wanted women listings in their classified sections, sometimes offering lower pay in the women's listings for the same exact jobs. One thing that was good for the equal pay movement in the 20th century was war. When the government wanted men to go and fight in World Wars I and II, women took more civilian jobs. Here's 48 seconds of a 1943 government film made to recruit women into factory work.
Women are called upon to leave their homes and take jobs. Among our young unmarried women and among older women whose children are grown, we have a large reserve. They discover that factory work is usually no more difficult than housework. Employers find that women can do many jobs as well as men, some jobs better. Tens of thousands of women are already at work in aircraft. More are being added as fast as they apply. This solves the breadwinning problem for many families whose men are at war. The government's policy is that women should get the same pay that men get for similar work. Where necessary, machinery is adapted for women's use. When a hand drill weighs heavily on feminine muscles, the lazy arm drill is introduced to take off the strain.
Now, for some reason, that 1943 film to recruit women into factory work was called Manpower. After the war, so many women left the out of the home workforce, went back into the home, but there was a new impetus to pass an equal pay law that covered the private sector for women who did work outside the home. And men tended to support that effort. They didn't want their jobs devalued by employers who thought that they could hire women in those jobs for lower wages. President Kennedy supported an equal pay bill in 1962.
Well, we are attempting to make sure that the women, for example, who work, one-third of our working force are women. We want to try to encourage every company in the United States and certainly stimulate governmental leadership in providing equal pay and equal conditions for women. 22 states do it now. We can do a much better job on that.
That was JFK in 62. In 63, the Equal Pay Act passed over the objection of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other business groups. President Lyndon Johnson addressed a group of women about it at the White House in 1964.
So America's progress toward a society of decency has been marked and measured by our attitudes toward the role and toward the rights of our women. We have made America stronger, not softer, as we have laid aside, gradually, one by one, the old biases and the ancient prejudices against the quality of women. One third of our working force are women, but they receive only about one fifth of the pay. The average full-time woman worker receives nearly $2,500 less than the average full-time male worker. This law is not a pay raise law, but it does say that wherever men and women do the same work, whether at the workbench or the office desk, they shall be paid equal wages for equal work. Let's open the door wider for all, just as we have opened it today for women.
A minute and a quarter of President Johnson in 1964. Note that he cited a stat in that clip that a third of the workforce back then was already women, but they made only a fifth of the pay. That gap is smaller today, but it is hardly gone. Women today make on average 80 cents for every dollar a man makes, according to the most widely published recent stats. One reason for that is that just because there's an Equal Pay Act on the books doesn't mean employers always obey it. So the next political battle after the Equal Pay Act of 1963 was passed was for meaningful enforcement of equal pay. Here's Vice President Al Gore in 1998 arguing for a bill that would impose consequences on employers who still engaged in pay discrimination.
So today, on behalf of President Clinton, who has fought tirelessly for pay equity, I'm proud to announce our strong support of the bill sponsored by Congresswoman DeLauro and Senator Daschle to strengthen the Equal Pay Act, and we will fight for this legislation. I call on Congress to pass this bill into law to give women compensatory and punitive damages when an employer pursues a wrongful policy of unequal pay.
Not just compensatory, but punitive damages to be given to the women in that 1990s bill, Vice President Gore in 1998. The back and forth over enforcement has been going on ever since, both in Congress and in the courts. Now, one important Supreme Court case came in 2007 when the Roberts Court ruled 5-4 that a Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company employee named Lily Ledbetter was not entitled to years of back pay for sex discrimination that she had proven. The issue was the court's interpretation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It said sex discrimination cases must be brought within 180 days of the discriminatory act. Ledbetter had brought her suit within 180 days of discovering she was getting unequal pay, but the court said she was not entitled to all the years of back pay to make up for all the time she was cheated before the most recent 180 days. Under President Bush, Congress could not pass a bill to change that law, and in the 2008 presidential election, John McCain opposed it too. But the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act became the first bill that President Obama signed into law when he took office in 2009. It clarifies the civil rights law to state that the clock for filing a lawsuit resets to 180 days after each discriminatory paycheck covering the ones that came before.
Now, equal pay is by no means just a women's issue. It's a family issue. It's about parents who find themselves with less money for tuition and childcare, couples who wind up with less to retire on, households where one breadwinner is paid less than she deserves. That's the difference between affording the mortgage or not, between keeping the heat on or paying the doctor bills or not. And in this economy, when so many folks are already working harder for less and struggling to get by, the last thing they can afford is losing part of each month's paycheck to simple and plain discrimination. So signing this bill today is to send a clear message that making our economy work means making sure it works for everybody.
President Obama in 2009. So equal pay for equal work is the law of the land, and there are some guarantees for enforcement. Progress is possible, but it's not complete. Equal pay still isn't always offered. There are various reasons more women are in lower-paying jobs, and the question of equal pay for comparable jobs has been a political non-starter. It's our 30 Issues election series. Issue 24, equal pay for equal and what about comparable work. We'll compare the current candidates' positions on this later in the week. With me now to discuss some of the history we just heard is Heidi Hartman, president and founder of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research. She founded it in 1987 to conduct woman-centered policy research. Thanks so much for doing this, Ms. Hartman. Welcome to WNYC.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
The basic concept is kind of shockingly obvious from today's sensibilities, right? If you're doing the exact same work, you should get the exact same pay, whether you're a man or a woman. But that wasn't obvious earlier in our history?
Well, it really wasn't. I mean, I love the example of the clerical workers at the Treasury Department making 50% of the men back in the late 1860s. And as late as the 1930s, really, that was an era when we had industrial organization and human resource policies, you know, coming into force as modern scientific processes in the workplace. And they would do job evaluations of the men's and women's jobs. And it would be often on a point system for this factor, responsibility, effort, working conditions, whatever. And there were some well-known corporations at the time that would say, okay, this man's job gets 100 points and this women's job gets 100 points, but we discount the women's pay by 20%. And even though they had had a system that said that, you know, even though these jobs were not identical, they were worth the same in terms of skill, effort, working conditions, and responsibility. And that was common practice, that it was perfectly fine to pay women less. And, you know, pretty much everybody did it. And it really began to be a lot of momentum for change during World War II. And many, many times women thought they would get an equal pay bill, which included, by the way, language on comparable worth. All of the drafts included language on comparable worth. They thought they would get it long before 1963. And when they finally got it, it was limited to equal pay for equal work.
And we'll come back to comparable worth in a couple of minutes. I was surprised reading the Time magazine history. I didn't know that New York City public school teachers were paid more if they were men until 1911. So I guess that was considered okay by sensibilities until then. And I was reading that in World War I, men went off to war and women went into civilian jobs that the government decided they could fill. And there were actual lists of jobs under the designation woman's work. That was an official federal government category during World War I, woman's work. Do you happen to know what are some of the jobs that got onto that list? I realize that's a very specific piece of history. I don't know if you know it.
I don't really, but I would imagine many clerical jobs. I think New York City was progressive if they eliminated unequal pay for women teachers in 1911. I mean, many school districts had it much, much longer.
How big a landmark was the Equal Pay Act of 1963?
Well, it was huge. I mean, it was the first time this was addressed in national legislation. And it had a enforcement mechanism, which was the Department of Labor, the Wage and Hours Unit. And it was followed, I think you might have had a quote on that in your history, by the executive order of Lyndon Johnson, which required federal contractors to not only pay equally, but to also not discriminate in hiring and promotion. And that, of course, was an echo or similar to the 64 mm-hmm. Civil Rights Act. So the
right.
two
so that
together,
executive order meant not just actual federal workers, but federal contractors in the private sector, too. They had to adhere to the same standards if they were going to get paid by the taxpayers.
That's right. And really, because the 1964 Civil Rights Act followed so closely upon the 1963 Equal Pay Act, you know, they both kind of blur together in terms of what their impacts were. It, of course, is enforced by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Many people don't think sex was included from the beginning, but it was. But the common sense is, the sense of most historians is that the agency did very little about sex discrimination or gender for quite some time. So it was in there, but they were not necessarily going after hiring and promotion discrimination, is my understanding.
Also on enforcement, President Obama is still fighting Congress in several ways. I'm reading now from the website info, please. And it says, in April 2014, he signed two executive orders to help eliminate wage disparities among federal contract workers. One order bans federal contractors from punishing workers who discuss salaries with coworkers, and the other calls on the Labor Department to create rules that require federal contractors to submit salary information broken down by race and gender to the federal government. The day after Obama signed the orders, Senate Republicans blocked a vote on the Paycheck Fairness Act, which would have imposed the measures included in the executive orders on the entire American workforce. It was the third time since 2010 that the Senate failed to consider the legislation. So for you as an activist in these areas or a advocate kind of researcher, would you like to see the government go that far, that every private employer has to provide salary information to the government broken down by race and gender? Employers would certainly find that onerous.
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's being worked on right now in the executive branch. First of all, let me clarify that IWPR is a research organization. We do not lobby. Of course, our research tends to show disparities, and when we are asked to testify, we do. And certainly we're happy to talk to the media about our research. Mm-hmm. My own personal view is that Paycheck Fairness Act, which hasn't passed yet, should be passed. Obviously, we still have a lot of wage disparity. I think you mentioned it was 80%. It's women are now making, according to data released a few weeks ago, 79.6%, generally rounded to 80% of what men make for year-round full-time work. So there's still a problem. On the data collection, it probably isn't that onerous. First of all, it wouldn't apply to every single employer, but only those that file the EEO-1, which I believe is in general companies with more than 100 workers. Most of those companies are already using automated payroll systems, and they already know the race and gender of their workers by occupation because they report that on the EEO-1. And since they already know that and they have automated pay, it's reasonably easy for them to calculate what would be the average pay, say, of full-time men and women working in broad occupational categories. The broad occupational categories that are being proposed are the same ones that they already report to the government on the EEO-1 form. And these are not data about any individual. These are broad occupational categories. And they would not be made available to the public. They're considered confidential. What a researcher can get is, the kind of, here's a gazillion companies and here's what they filed, but you won't know which company filed which form. So for researchers, it would be, useful to improve the research that can now be done with the EEO-1 forms. You can already use them for research, but now there would be wage data attached. So I don't actually view it personally as that onerous.
So they're already reporting the race and gender makeup of their workforces. You're saying this would just attach wage information to that form.
The average wage information, right, for the men and women by different race groups in that large occupational category. A large occupational category is like managers, clerical workers, blue-collar workers. These are big, very big categories. But it would still be helpful, and I believe it would be helpful to the enforcement agencies to see where the issues are.
As we talk for another few minutes about equal pay for equal work, issue 24 in our 30 issues election series, Jim in the Bronx is calling in. Jim, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. Would comparable work rules forbid distinctions in pay based on seniority, experience, or rank? For instance, I'm in academia, and of course we have different ranks within the profession, adjuncts, lecturers, assistant professors, full professors, based on experience, based on publications and this sort of thing. But we all teach more or less exactly the same classes for exactly the same number of hours per week. So would a comparable wage law forbid distinctions based on rank, on experience, on seniority, on ability?
Jim, that's a great question.
To teach you exactly the same kinds of materials.
Great question. And Heidi Hartman, before we even get to the question of comparable worth, which is his specific question, the Equal Pay Act already makes exceptions, even for people in the exact same job, for things like merit and seniority when those are considered qualifications in a particular workforce. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. And the same, to my knowledge, would apply in comparable worth. Where you might see something for a college professor would be that the nursing professor would be considered comparable to the engineering professor, and those salaries might be brought up. I'm willing to bet that the nursing professors are on a much lower scale. So full professor rank two in nursing with 30 years experience probably makes less than full professor rank two in engineering with 30 years of experience. So that's the kind of thing where you would expect across disciplines might be they might be brought into alignment.
Uh-huh. So maybe that's why this has been a failed political movement so far, the comparable worth movement, not just equal pay for equal work. The idea that the government would get involved in identifying all kinds of jobs, and that's as good an example as any, nursing professors compared to engineering professors, and the government is going to say, no, we deem these comparable, and so the pay scales have to be the same. Is that the idea?
Well, it's not exactly the idea. The idea is that the government would require the employer to investigate what jobs are incomparable in their own firms and pay them the same. So everything is always left up to the employer. And then, of course, just like now, you could sue for unequal pay in the same job. Then you'd be able to sue for unequal pay in a comparable job. So interestingly enough, this was not always a failed movement. In the 70s and 80s, we had a number of lawsuits that were won at various levels of the court system, and whole state civil services changed their pay to bring women's pay closer to men's pay on average across the board. And they did that. I mean, it didn't get equal, but it got closer. And they did that by bringing up the wages of what were considered, when they did these job evaluation schemes, undervalued jobs. And
can you give me an example or two?
Well, prison guards, that was one of the cases. Male and female guards, guards in male prisons and female prisons were being paid differently. And you might think that job was the same, but it was kind of considered a comparable job because there were different duties involved. The overall thing would be an entire civil service. So maybe secretaries would be brought up, librarians would be brought up, nurses would be brought up. You know, in some places, child care workers were making less than parking lot attendants who worked for a city or a state. So those would be brought up. Minnesota passed laws saying that counties and localities had to do comparable worth studies and improve the pay alignment of jobs that were found to be similar. So in the reason it focused on the public sector is that that's where there was wage information. Generally, wages are public in the public sector, so you know, a child care worker can say, wait, the parking guy is making more than me, and complain about it. And they have politicians that they can appeal to. And so these laws were passed and studies were done and wages were raised. So it did happen. But finally, there was a negative case from the Supreme Court. And at that time, you know, the advocates thought it was covered by Title VII. And then new legislation was written. It has a name, I think it's called the Fair Pay Act. President Obama, when he was in the Senate, was one of 11 senators to support the Fair Pay Act. So the Fair Pay Act is still often introduced in Congress. I'm not sure if it's absolutely every session. But you're absolutely right. It has gone nowhere in recent history. But it is out there as an idea still. And I think it will come back because people will realize that you can't get rid of the whole pay gap unless you do a better job on comparable pay, and unless you do a better job essentially on affirmative action, on integrating the best paid jobs, like whether they're in STEM or whether it's CEO of a Fortune 500 company. If we don't start seeing a more equal representation of women in all those jobs and better pay for, let's say, home healthcare workers, we won't see completely equal pay.
John in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for having me on, and I love this conversation, and I love the guest. A quick question about, for the guest, Freakonomics did a really interesting story about this earlier in the summer, and they had Claudia Golden, who I guess is an economics professor at Harvard, and she said that this is a way more complicated story, and I would love the guest's thoughts on this, but she said basically equal pay for equal work was really a closer to like a 95% gap, and it's the complications or the complexities in the disparity really comes from what she called like a care bias, in that we as a society look way more for women to take the lead in childcare, and as a result, that that has a bigger impact. Now, I don't know if that's true, but I thought it was interesting, yeah. And Stephen Dubner reported it as true. So I would love to hear the guest thoughts on, I'm sort of hearing both sides of this, and I would love to hear a response to that.
Right. So when we say 80 cents that a woman makes for every dollar a man makes, does that take into account that women on average work fewer hours per year if they have children at home than men do? And women sometimes are on a slower track of even what jobs they will take because of the childcare responsibilities that they take on more than the men in the kids' lives?
Say, gee, if Steve Dubner said it was true, it must be true. But seriously, Claudia Golden and I talk often and exchange views on these matters, and we have great respect for each other. First of all, I think most economists agree that the fact that women are doing more of the family work is affecting their job prospects. Many of them do work less than full-time, but that ratio that we use is for full-time year-round workers. Now, even within that, men on average do work more hours, but it's not enough more to account for the whole 20% gap.
Right. So last question, and then we're going to did you want to finish something on that?
Well, just to say that we lag what other countries have in terms of paid family leave, child care support, all of those things, and I think Claudia would agree if we could do more of them here, we would see women's wages catch up a bit.
So last question. I read that the gap for women under 25 is much smaller. It's like 94 cents for every dollar. Older women have more of a gap. Does that mean we're going to age out of equal pay disparities as equity becomes a standard practice and a cultural value?
I wish. But this phenomenon of younger women doing better than older women has been around for about 50 years. I mean, it goes up with every new cohort of women, so 94 is probably the best ratio that younger women have had. But as they age, the gap grows, and that's happened to every past cohort, and I imagine it will happen to this one. And, of course, you know, many people speculate it has to do with the childbearing years. But not all women have children, and yet all women seem to suffer from this disadvantage, you could say, that, well, you could have had children, or you might have had children, or anyway, you did have a child 30 years ago. What difference does it make if you had a child 30 years ago and you took a year off at the time? So it's unfortunately, you know, a kind of cultural thing that to pay women less is still accepted in many ways, and women's jobs pay less. So, you know, we're going to have to make a lot of changes to get where we want to be.
Heidi Hartman, president and founder of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's our 30 Issues election series, issue 24, Equal Pay for Equal and What About Comparable Work? We'll compare the current candidates' positions tomorrow. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our 30 Issues election series. We're in issue 24 this week, Equal Pay for Equal Work, and What About for Comparable Work? The issue came up at the Oscars last year when Patricia Arquette got her statue for Best Supporting Actress in Boyhood.
Every woman who gave birth to every taxpayer and citizen of this nation, we have fought for everybody else's equal rights. It's our time to have wage equality once and for all, and equal rights for women in the United States of America.
Patricia Arquette at the 2015 Oscar ceremony. Women who work full-time make on average 80 cents for every dollar a full-time working man makes in the United States. So how much is this a matter for government intervention? Well, yesterday we listened to the issue through audio history from the 1940s through President Obama. You can still hear that audio history tour on our website. I think it's really interesting. Today we'll compare the current presidential candidates, and they are very different on this. In the Senate, Hillary Clinton was an original co-sponsor of the Lilly Ledbetter Law, which allows women to sue for back wages under the Equal Pay Act for as far back as the employer has been paying her illegally less than men. Before Lilly Ledbetter, they could only recoup what they were cheated out of for the most recent 6 months. And Clinton, as a senator, introduced the Paycheck Fairness Act in 2005 and 2007, which is still being debated today. That would help fight paycheck discrimination by allowing employees to reveal their comparative wages without retaliation from their employers. Here is Clinton talking about that at a campaign stop in April.
We should pass the Paycheck Fairness Act, which gives women the legal tools we need to fight discrimination at work. I introduced this legislation back in the Senate in 2005, and I kept sponsoring it again and again. Well, it's time to get this done once and for all.
Clinton in April. President Obama is for that Paycheck Fairness Act, which would allow employees to reveal their comparative wages without retaliation from their employers. Donald Trump is quite the opposite. But as with many Donald Trump policy areas, his position is contradictory. At the Republican convention in July, the big pitch to women, remember, came in his daughter Ivanka's speech, and she had something to say about pay equity.
At my father's company, there are more female than male executives. Women are paid equally for the work that we do, and when a woman becomes a mother, she is supported, not shut out. Policies that allow women with children to thrive should not be novelties, they should be the norm. Politicians talk about wage equality, but my father has made it a practice at his company throughout his entire career. He will fight for equal pay, for equal work, and I will fight for this too, right alongside of him.
Ivanka Trump at the Republican convention. But here's the candidate himself. At a campaign stop in Iowa in November, he seemed to not even support the Equal Pay Act as it stands, which has been the law of the land since 1964 and requires equal pay for substantially equal work.
Here's the problem. If you start getting involved with government on this one gets this pay and this one gets that pay, and then you say, where does it all start? Because you could have a woman that's much better than a man. You could have a woman that's not as good as a man. If you sort of say everybody gets equal pay, you get away from the whole American dream. You get away from capitalism, in a sense. I can tell you that I have women, honestly, that are just, in many cases, they're better than men, and I pay them more than men. And to a certain extent, people have to go out there. They have to fight for themselves. Once you get, and I don't know if people agree with me, once you get it where everybody gets the same, and you're into a socialistic society.
Equal pay, you get away from the whole American dream. Trump in Des Moines in November. The Equal Pay Act does make exceptions, by the way, for positions that are paid according to merit or according to seniority. Now, I'll point out that the third-party candidates have weighed in on this, too. I don't have sound bites, but the issue website isidewith.com asked Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, should employers be required to pay men and women the same salary for the same job? Gary Johnson's answer, no. There are too many other variables such as education, experience, and tenure that determine a fair salary, he said. Jill Stein's answer, yes, and businesses should be required to publish their salary ranges for each position. So for the candidates more on the right, Johnson and Trump seem to be in about the same place. For the candidates more on the left, Stein seems to go further than Clinton in that Stein calls for a requirement that business publish their employee salary ranges. And here on our 30 Issues election series, issue 24, Equal Pay, with me with more analysis and also to talk about some campaign news of today, if we have time, is Time Magazine political correspondent Jay Newton Small. She's also the author of the relevant book, Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way America Works, published this year. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Brian.
First, what do you make of Ivanka Trump's language and how different it is from Donald Trump's language?
It is strikingly different. And I, as I wrote at the time when she gave that speech at the Republican National Convention, that she really did sound like Hillary Light. I mean, most of Hillary's speeches do focus on a lot of these issues. In fact, Hillary's biggest applause line is her call for equal pay in almost any of her speeches, her stump speeches across the campaign trail. And Ivanka's speech almost took a page out of Hillary's book and hit many, many, many similar issues. And so it was striking to hear that right before she introduced her father, who has hardly spoken about any of these issues, and in his speech did not talk about these issues and has hardly spoken about them since.
And can you talk about the fair pay legislation that's stuck in Congress? It has to do, like I said before, with retribution for revealing your own or your colleagues' pay?
So there's actually a bunch of equal pay bills. And so the one that you're talking about is sponsored by mostly Democrats, in fact, all Democrats. And it does right now, if you reveal your salary to other coworkers, or somebody tells you that you're not being paid equally, and they've seen your salary numbers and they've seen equivalent salary numbers to other coworkers of yours, you can actually be punished by your company for sort of disclosing proprietary information, essentially, and get into trouble for it. And which makes essentially disclosing or discovering equal pay disparities incredibly difficult. And so the bill would sort of allow these exchanges of information to go on, or essentially whistleblowers to say, hey, I've seen the payrolls, women are being paid unfairly here, and therefore, you know, companies would have to answer much more publicly to discriminatory pay practices if they exist. There's been a lot of resistance from Republicans in passing this bill, and in fact, Republicans on the other side have their own equal pay bills. And so you look at Deb Fischer, who's a senator from Nebraska, Kelly Ayotte, who's a senator from New Hampshire, in the last session, together with Mitch McConnell, who's the majority leader, introduced a bill in the Senate that didn't do anything like this. It actually took the other stance of sort of incentivizing companies to more transparently disclose this information, incentivizing companies to pay women equally. And Republicans argue that the Democratic approach is just a sop to sort of trial lawyers, and that it's just going to enrich trial lawyers, and that it's to the detriment of both women and companies, and that really the best tack to take is to just incentivize companies to do this, and then they'll do it naturally.
Do you know what kinds of incentives they offer that would be strong enough to get employers to actually do it without the fear of lawsuits?
Well, and that's the problem, is that Democrats argue that these bills are toothless, that they're not actually going to do anything to encourage employers to fully disclose this information, because it really is only the fear of litigation and lawsuits that would force companies to do this, because it would make such a big difference on their payroll. As you said, women are actually paid on average about 79 cents on the dollar to men in America. Salesforce, for example, is a company that most recently, there were two women on the payroll who challenged their CEO to prove that he was paying women equally. He sort of gladly took the challenge and said, of course we pay women equally, and kind of abashedly a year later, or a few months later, realized and admitted that they were not actually paying women equally and had to increase his payrolls by $3 million a year in order to bring women up to equal pay as men. Hmm. That's something that companies, it's very expensive. It's something that companies don't really want to do unless they're kind of forced to do it. And so I think unless you really force them to do it or shame them and publicly in ways to do it, then they're not really going to do it.
So we can't tell from what Ivanka Trump said in her Republican convention speech whether her father supports the Democratic Fair Pay Act with disclosure of other people's salaries being okay versus the Mitch McConnell bill with the incentives?
No, but strikingly, the language that Ivanka chose in describing equal pay was very similar to the language that was chosen by Deb Fischer and Kelly Ayotte in rolling out the bill. So my guess is that she's more talking about the Republican stance on this bill, just by sort of looking at the dog whistles of the language. But she has remained incredibly unclear about which one of the bills they actually support and what they would actually do.
Jane Newton Small, Time Magazine political correspondent and author of Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way America Works. Tomorrow, Jay, we'll do a separate segment in this series on comparable worth, different jobs that advocates want declared comparable for pay legislation purposes. Like a guest yesterday mentioned cases where security guards get higher pay than child care workers, I guess for the same employer, and wanted that disparity legislated under comparable worth. Another example she gave was nursing professors getting less than engineering professors at colleges and universities. But has Clinton or have any of them taken a position, to your knowledge, on comparable worth?
No, and that is, you know, it is a problem, but it's one that's very hard to solve. And so there is a sort of capital slight that happens when women infiltrate certain professions. For example, when women became more and more into the medical field, the pay scale for pediatricians and primary care doctors, as women began to become infiltrate that field, actually decreased. And so and a lot of the money has now gone to specialties like surgery, where women are, you know, make up less than 10% of surgeons. Same thing has happened in Wall Street, arguably, where all of the money was in investment banking. Then as women became more and more investment bankers, the money left and went into private equity. Then when women got into private equity, the money left again and went to hedge funds. And now most of the money is in hedge funds, and there's very, very few women. Something like only 7% of women are in hedge funds. So there is this kind of capital flight that happens. And the only way to really stop that from happening, if you look at studies or you talk to experts, is to really have women fully permeate the workforce, and so that there is nowhere for the capital to go when you have women in every sector and every level of the workforce.
Let's take a phone call from a business owner who doesn't like the idea of government getting into his payroll books. Scott in Red Bank, you're on WNYC. Scott, thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing, Brian?
Okay.
Love the show. Always listen.
Thank you.
Big NPR fans here.
Go ahead.
Hey, my problem is it feels very big brotherish. I mean, I own a janitorial service. I have several women and several men working for me. I'm with them every day out on the jobs, and I know who's doing the most work and getting the most work done. Part of it is just physical capacity. Most of the men that work for me are able to do more work than most of the women just because of the amount of equipment we have to move, the amount of physical labor that we do. And I can't pay them all equally. When I have a guy doing more work than the woman's doing, he's not going to want to work the exact same pay if he's getting more work done. Mm-hmm. How do I justify to him that I'm paying her the same as you, even though you're getting more work done and you're making more money for me, mm-hmm. and she's making less money for me?
So, Jay, how does the Equal Pay Act as it stands, which has been the law of the land since 1964, take different workers' productivity into account? Do you know if it does?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure how the law that stands works, but, I mean, the catchphrase around Washington has always been equal pay for equal work. And the idea being that if you have different tiers of different work, then women should be paid the same as men for the exact same jobs that they're doing. If those jobs are different, if women aren't as productive, if women have a different scale of work, then obviously that should be taken into account. And you shouldn't necessarily pay, you know, women more for doing less work. I think that is unfair. And so in which case, my guess would be that you would just simply scale the amount of physical productivity and pay for that particular amount of work, and that would be your justification. I don't think that you could be sued under the Equal Pay Act as it stands for paying women less if they're actually producing less.
And there is an exception in the Equal Pay Act, as I understand it, for merit. And I don't know if productivity, the way Scott just described it, would fall under the legal definition of merit in that respect. But you're saying you don't think he would be in violation of the act the way he described his situation. Scott, thank you very much for calling. Trump unveiled a maternity leave plan the other week, which was 6 weeks of paid maternity leave for, I guess, women of newborns. I don't know if adoption is taken into account in that, but 6 weeks of paid maternity leave for the mothers only, and that would be funded through unemployment insurance, federal unemployment insurance program. Some people have pushed back on that as having an implication for the equal pay conversation, because since it's just maternity leave and not parental leave, which fathers could also take, it makes women more of an economic risk than men for the same mm-hmm. jobs. And so it might discourage employers from hiring women if they do it Trump's way rather than Clinton's way, which is to have the 12 weeks of paid maternity leave. 12 weeks of paid parental or family leave, but available to either the mother or the father.
And certainly that it is the biggest lag or the biggest driver of unequal pay is what they call the motherhood penalty. And so on average, women end up taking four to seven years off of their careers in order to do either childcare or parental care because they are the primary caregivers in most families. And that is the biggest driver of the fact that they get paid less equally than men because there's a lag, right? And if you and one of the solutions in the modern workforce that people say is to this lag is that you give men equal access to paternity leave so that if they want to be the primary caregiver of a child and allow their wives to go and be the primary breadwinner, then they should be allowed to do that. And that would go a long way to solving this maternity gap because men would then theoretically have the same sort of potential gap as women have. And it is certainly a really big problem in America. And you see increasingly, I think, millennials trying to solve this problem, and I think that's really interesting. So, for example, 30% of first contacts in kindergartners today are fathers. And that number rises to, I think, almost 50% in Silicon Valley, where young men are really changing the definition of work. It used to be kind of a thing of shame where if men said, I want to go, leave work early to go pick up my kid, they were sort of, people would look in their office, look at them and say, hey, that's not what men do at work. You're supposed to be here, you're supposed to be working. Increasingly, millennial men, and millennials are the first generation born assuming the equality of the sexes, millennial men are pushing back and saying, no, I want to be a very hands-on father. I want flexible working hours so that I can be involved with my child's life. I want to telecommute so that I can work from home. I want to do part-time work so I can help raise my kids. And that is beginning to change the workforce in ways that I think it, just giving maternity leave the way Trump is envisioning would actually limit that change.
Jay Newton Small, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine and author of Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way America Works. Jay, thank you so much for doing this.
Brian, thanks for having me on.
In our 30 Issues election series, we're in issue 24 this week, equal pay for equal work, and what about for comparable work? Tomorrow, we'll delve into that comparable work discussion. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll talk to the author of a new book called Take Pride, Why the Deadliest Sin Holds the Secret to Human Success. Stay with us. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our 30 Issues election series. We're in issue 24 this week, Equal Pay for Equal Work. And today, specifically, Equal Pay for Work of Equal Value, also known as comparable worth. While Trump and Clinton debate equal pay for equal work, as we talked about earlier in the week, the notion of equal pay for comparable worth, which was hot in the 80s and 90s, has mostly fallen off the political map. The premise of comparable worth theory is that there is a broad-based market failure in American capitalism that undervalues jobs that women tend to do. Our guest on Wednesday's show, Heidi Hartman, president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, gave this example.
Where you might see something for a college professor would be that the nursing professor would be considered comparable to the engineering professor. and those salaries might be brought up. I'm willing to bet that the nursing professors are on a much lower scale. So full professor rank two in nursing with 30 years experience probably makes less than full professor rank two in engineering with 30 years of experience. So that's the kind of thing where you would expect across disciplines might be they might be brought into alignment.
Heidi Hartman here on Wednesday. She also cited parking lot attendants who sometimes make more than child care workers, which takes more skill. Now, comparable worth programs are rare, but they do exist. A Santa Clara University article from back in the 90s that I found this morning gives the example of Minnesota state government, where state jobs were rated according to required level of education, training, stress, customer or client contact, and responsibility. And in that case, for example, registered nurses and vocational education teachers were each rated the same, but the salary for nurses, who are mostly women, was only $1,700 per month, while the salary for vocational education teachers, who were mostly men, was $2,200. New York State does have a comparable worth law. According to the human resources consulting site HR.BLR, the New York Equal Pay Law prohibits sex discrimination in compensation for jobs in the same establishment that require equal skill, effort, and responsibility, and that are performed under similar working conditions. The law applies to all employers, regardless of size. It's New York Labor Law, Section 194, if you want to look it up. Neither Clinton nor Trump has raised comparable worth as an issue, but the Society for Human Resource Managers has an article worrying that Clinton's interest in allowing employees to legally disclose their salaries to coworkers could move us closer to a comparable worth system. Let's have a short debate about comparable worth. With us now are compensation specialist Jim Brennan, a former senior associate at the Economic Research Institute, a salary survey and research company. He's for comparable pay. And Hadley Manning, a senior policy analyst at the Independent Women's Forum, a politically conservative nonprofit focused on economic policy issues concerning women, shall argue against comparable worth. Welcome to WNYC, Hadley Manning and Jim Brennan. Hi.
Hi. Hi, good morning.
Jim, you want to make your case for comparable worth in general, and then Hadley will respond?
Well, you did a nice job in bringing back my memories from the 80s by citing my friend Heidi Hartman and talking about the Minnesota state, where I was the consultant to the state at that time, too.
Huh.
Heidi happened to have been one of the co-authors of the seminal work by the National Academy of Sciences named, appropriately enough, Equal Pay for Work of Equal Value, which is your topic. And in that report, she and Professor, well, PhD, Don Triman, a fellow economist, also established with statistical precision that there's a part correlation formula that you can actually use without doing job evaluation to prove the amount of disparate impact that gender has on pay. Meaning, if you know that a job is dominated by women, it tends to be paid substantially under the usual rate for the same kind of work if it's done by a man. The more men there are in a profession, in an occupation, then the more equal and equitable the pay rates are. Now, this is legal in the United States. It's perfectly appropriate and popular to literally discriminate, which is to make a difference, against women in pay if their job is not precisely identical to the work held by a man. That's the problem with the Equal Pay Act of 1963. If there's not identity of all elements, then you can successfully argue quite properly that the job is not identical. It's not equal. It's even though it's substantially the same and equivalent, it's not comparable. It's comparable, but you don't have to pay what's comparable. And frankly, HR people, and that's my background, I was a business consultant after winning my spurs at corporate HR positions and compensation departments all over the country. And what companies do in HR and personnel is very practical. They try to restrain expenses. That means you don't want to pay a penny more than you have to for your human talent.
So let me jump in here. And before Hadley goes, I just want to invite listeners, if anyone has a comparable worth example or a comparable worth wish list example. What job that usually winds up as women's work is undercompensated, in your opinion, compared to something of similar skill or training level usually done by men that anybody listening right now want to raise? Interested in specific examples, real or hypothetical. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Hadley Manning, you're up. Why not?
Hi, good morning. So I think that this issue really starts with the question of pay disparity. Why is there a pay disparity between what women earn broadly in the economy and what men earn? And if you believe that the disparity is primarily driven by discrimination, then you might be tempted by the idea of comparable worth pay. But if you understand that there are many other factors that generally influence how wages are set, then you understand that comparable worth won't get us anywhere as women. And what I mean by this is today we have a mechanism for setting wages generally in various positions, and that is supply and demand, the market forces that are at work. And, you know, what Jim was saying about the professions where women congregate, I think is really a chicken and the egg question. Are these professions lower paid because women congregate in those professions, or do women congregate in those professions because women tend to seek out other priorities when they choose a job? And by other priorities, I mean job conditions or benefits or flexibility, things that you have to pay an economic cost for, namely lower wages. And I would just caution this about comparable worth. If we pursue some kind of policy like this, it's very subjective to use any other mechanism besides a market to set wages. And the ultimate result, as we've seen in the state of Minnesota, where they used this policy for state workers, is we'll see slower growth in those fields that are generally dominated by women. So we don't want to do anything that's going to limit job opportunities for women. Economists generally oppose comparable worth policies because we understand that this will cause great market inefficiency, distort incentives in the labor market, and ultimately result in fewer job opportunities for women.
Could you clarify why you think it would result in fewer job opportunities for women?
Right. So I believe the ultimate goal of advocates for comparable worth is to raise the wages for women in jobs that are traditionally female-dominated. And what will happen if you raise wages above what the market today says is the price of that labor, then effectively you're going to force employers or ask employers to pay a price above what they are paying in a market setting. And whenever we ask employers to do that, they will compensate by eliminating those jobs or hiring fewer people into those jobs. It's the economic concept. When you raise the price of something, people consume less of it.
All right. Jim Brennan, respond to any parts of that.
Oh, sure. I mean, Hebdy makes some very good points, and I agree completely because I'm a labor economist myself, is that skill, effort, responsibility, and working conditions account for a substantial amount of the pay differential between men and women. That's just one of the protected class categories. There's also race, sex, age, national origin, disability, and other elements that enter into it. But the reality here is the market is an empty rebuttal argument. It doesn't make sense because business does not follow, quote, the market, unquote, because there is no one market for labor. No two companies pay exactly the same rate for any job, no matter how consistent or benchmark it is between organizations. They take whatever they want to survey. They say that they use that as a guideline, and then they pay something different from what the survey shows. They do that as a matter of choice, policy, tradition, preference, and habit. And the habit is you do not inflate costs any more than you have to, unless perhaps you need to fill an engineering job in which you pay whatever the market requires. But if it happens to be a secretary versus a truck driver, well, you don't pay the secretary more. You automate the job, or you outsource it, or you make the manager do their own typing and use a dictaphone. The other point is that the market was also used to defend slavery and child labor. And I don't buy into the concept that women deserve lower pay because they select these jobs where they are dead-ended or mommy-tracked. In my own profession, the Compensation Association, we did a survey of our own membership, and it proved that after you identified every one of the legitimate variables that do cause a choice between what is proper and not for men and women, size, title, number of employees, all these variables that go into setting wages, you count all those elements, and once you get to sex, you subtract 14.3%. because if you're a woman, if you're a compensation executive, even in the compensation profession, you get paid less.
Let me take a phone call from a listener with an example that she feels reflects that women get paid less for work that they're that should be seen as comparable to certain male-dominated professions. Christine in Bloomfield, you're on WNYC. Hi, Christine.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. Are you a social worker?
Yes, I am a social worker. I work with children in New Jersey. And obviously social work is a profession dominated by women. But I think, you know, in addition to the gender piece of this, social work is a profession that doesn't necessarily produce a commodity. So we don't make money off of what we produce. But it is more of a long-term investment into society. And unfortunately, I don't think that our society values that. I'm a master's level professional, and I'm not receiving what I believe is master's level pay, and that's across the board in this profession.
Can you think of a particular male-dominated master's level profession that you'd like to compare it to?
In a totally different field, marketing, business, where these people have MBAs and are making six figures, a few years out of college, a few years out of graduate school, that's something that social workers may never even reach. And though I would argue that the level of stress, work, contact between client and professional may be greater.
Christine, thank you very much. So, Hadley, does it bother you at all as a woman or just as a human being that people who deal in commodities, as Christine put it, are so rewarded by the market, whereas people who deal in things that are so vital to our society, like social work for families and children, as Christine describes her field, is valued so little, and should nothing be done to intervene in that disparity?
Well, I certainly commend our social workers and other people who work in professions where they are interacting with the people in our society who truly need help. So I appreciate deeply the work that she's doing. Some of the things that the caller said about her job remind me, in fact, of my own job, because I work for a nonprofit organization, and we are a political organization. We work in public policy. So in a way, we, too, are trying to make an investment long-term in improving our society. We don't produce a commodity. And so of that, I would say, I can speak for myself.
There are people who would take exception to comparing working for a conservative think tank to being a social worker with children and families, but go ahead.
Of course. But I would say of my own choices, I made a choice to enter this profession. I could have chosen to go to business school. I could have chosen to go to law school. Those are choices that are open and equal to men and women. And so ultimately, when we make these choices as women, there are reasons why we're doing so, whether that's because we find social work very compelling. We have a big heart, and we see a need in our society. So we want to answer that need. And there are rewards to that work that are non-monetary. So I would say, ultimately, the choices are in our hands as women. We should feel empowered by the fact that we have these choices, and we have the information in front of us as well. We know what different professions pay, and to suggest that women are somehow brainwashed into entering fields that are lower paying is sort of insulting, I believe.
That's interesting.
Women.
Christine, you still there?
Yes.
Did you hear that argument? You could have chosen.
Yeah, I have a pretty strong reaction to that argument.
You could have chosen to be a commodities trader if you wanted.
Yes, but I do think that as just humans, we go into professions where we have strengths. My strength happens to be working with people and my clinical expertise. Nurses, psychiatrists have clinical expertise similar to mine. They make much more money than I do. I kind of feel I take offense to the fact that, I somehow chose a lesser profession for some reason. I think that my profession needs to be compensated, in a greater amount. And I don't think it really has to do with what my choices were. I chose this because this is what I'm good at and this is what the world needs.
Christine, thank you very much. So, Jim Brennan, this is a challenge for you because even if everybody agrees with this morally and ethically, it's such a thicket if government gets into the business of saying, okay, we're going to raise wages for social workers relative to commodity traders because of the human value of that. How does it work? How broadly could it work on a practical basis?
It should never be done by government. This is an area where comparable worth advocates get turn into a red herring situation where they're accused of Looney Tunes arguments that they don't agree with. Arguments are attributed to them, or thoughts were attributed to them. We don't believe in that. We believe that every employer has a right to establish and maintain its own equitable pay system. That's essential to our economy. And by the way, that exists in every economy. It's not just capitalism. It's also socialism, communism, feudalism. They all have their own value systems, and these problems all exist there. We have social problems behind it, too, as properly noted. There is a tendency for our society, and it's always been this way for every society through history, to classify jobs according to the gender of the performers. There are such things as men's dirt and women's dirt. You know that? Men's dirt, things like soil, grease, and coal, where women's dirt would be things like blood, baby poop, and house dust, okay? One type of dirt is valued a lot more than the other. You know, grass cutters get paid more than babysitters. Come on now. Now, this is a social value, and that happens to be endemic in our culture. At the same time, it's not really defined by the commercial value of the product, because a marketing advertising expert or a commodities trader doesn't make anything. They're persuading people, just as a social worker is trying to enrich the values and the lives of their clients. But we don't want to get caught up in false choices. I want to point out that the difference here is that every employer should establish its own equitable pay system with no basis that's influenced by the gender, the sex, or the age or the color of the incumbent, of the performer of the work. If you have a pay system that's market predictive for males, it should be the same system applied to the women. That doesn't happen. You'll find that almost every major employer has a different pay system for the female jobs than it does for the male jobs. Come on now. What they're doing is they're saying we'll treat the market differently for men than we do for women. They use the data selectively. That's the dirty secret that theoreticians don't know about because they haven't been down in the trenches dealing with it, as I have for 50 years.
Let me get one more call in here, and I'm going to take the same caller who was on with Heidi Hartman on Wednesday, who raised the college professor disparate pay question, and it's Jim in the Bronx. Jim, hi, you're back on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So on Wednesday, your guest said that, for instance, an engineering professor and a nursing professor of the same rank at a university should get the same pay as comparable work. Well, I want to respond to why that's wrong. For instance, engineering professors, for instance, can often be hired away, find jobs in the financial industry, in corporate management. Many financial firms prefer engineers, while I'm sure a nursing professor can find other things to do, but probably less lucrative. So even within the same institution, the same general field, there are vast differences that this kind of micromanagement of society in the name of fairness simply will not, achieve the desired results or have negative backlashes.
Jim, thank you. So, Jim Brennan, that's a challenge for you.
Sure. I don't intend or want to see any government agency setting wages for anybody. I think that's ridiculous. It won't work. And no one in comparable work recommends that. Instead, they say there should be an ability of the citizens to assure the fairness of the internal pay practices of those companies. And by the way, this is a big reason for a lot of the resistance to transparency in pay. Even though it is civil right, it's a civil right covered by the National Labor Relations Board as well. Everyone is entitled to discuss their salaries. It's a protected act. But you can't get to do it without running the risk of being fired. And if you're fired, you can win the lawsuit, but it's very costly. People don't want to do that. The point is you can have a right in paper. It doesn't mean it happens in effect. What we need government to do is to assure the equality of treatment, not to brand there is only one value system. That's ridiculous. No one asserts that, nor claims that, or intends it. It's just don't distort market arguments by saying that everything is based on the market. It's not. You talk to any company what they pay. You find out what they pay. If you're in a survey organization, you give them ideas and concepts about pay, but they pick and choose the data and use it as they want. They just use it differently for women than they do for men.
We just have 1 minute left in this segment. Hadley, is this a politically dead issue? I mean, I presented it as kind of reviving something that was around and had a few victories and died out in the 90s. Is this a dead letter politically?
Well, it should be. It should be a dead idea because ultimately we have to keep in mind what the result will be when we tinker with the market price of labor
right.
in different professions.
So should be.
And you know, men's, and Jim talked about men's dirt. There's a reason why the market rewards some of these dangerous and dirty jobs because the market has to do that in order to attract workers mm-hmm. into those fields. When we change those things, we're going to see different incentives from workers and employers that will result in large shortages and surpluses in different industries that will be bad for all of us.
Jim, is this pretty dead?
No, it's not dead. It'll come back again because we're dealing with an issue that addresses the majority of our population. The majority of the working population, every man has daughters, well, not every man, but we have daughters, we have spouses, we have wives, they're female. We are looking at what's happening to them in the workplace,
right.
and a lot of men are starting to scratch their head and saying, how come we have different rules?
Compensation specialist Jim Brennan and Hadley Manning from the Independent Women's Forum, thank you both very much for engaging today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And that's issue 24 in our 30 issues election series, equal pay and maybe comparable, equal pay for equal and maybe comparable work. Next week, issue 25, the economy is or isn't rigged. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us.